Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and in case anyone's wondering, still in lockdown, with a baby and a three-year-old. It's great, it's so good. But you know, it was Australia's turn, I guess, to get pandemicked. And we'll be out of this soon enough. So to all of the listeners in Australia and New Zealand who are also in lockdown, just remember, we got some vaccine supply now. Things are starting to move and this should be over soon enough. But let's push on through, shall we? In a moment, we'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about the week's security news, of course. And after that, we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, Airlock Digital. Now, I should disclose that in addition to them being a Risky Biz sponsor, I'm doing other, like, non-Risky Biz related work with them. And I should further disclose that I have drunk the Kool-Aid on this one hard. Airlock makes a hybrid allow and block listing product for enterprise environments that's actually usable. And two of the Airlock people will be joining us this week to talk about EDR bypasses. Now, I want to be clear, this thing, you know, what we're talking about, it's not an attack on EDR. EDR is great, particularly at the D and the R in the name, the detection and the response. But in terms of prevention, it's probably not as great as people think it is. Now, that's not their fault. The real problem, as I see it at least, is it's 2021 and we still allow users to execute whatever code they want by default and then rely on controls to detect the intent of those executions, and we rely on user permissions to try to restrict the fallout of those actions. And it's a shitty approach. It's just a straight up shitty approach to the security problem in this year of our Lord 2021, especially when we now have tools like Airlock that can really change that paradigm. Anyway, Daniel Schell and David Cottingham from Airlock Digital will be along a little bit later on to talk through an EDR bypass paper from a Greek university that was actually pretty interesting. So do stick around for that one. That is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines. And Adam, we got a nice week here. There's not too many stories. I'm not looking at like 50 tabs in front of me. So this is a refreshing change. So we can actually talk about some of this stuff in detail. The first piece I want to talk about is actually from Patrick Howell O'Neill at MIT Technology Review. And I think he's written probably one of the better stories here about the cyber partisans in Belarus. This is the group that claim to be hacktivists who, exfilled a whole bunch of data that's critical to the functioning of the Belarusian sort of security apparatus. And yeah, he's got a write-up really talking about this group. It's interesting stuff.
Yeah, this is a really good kind of return to the subject, because we talked, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago on the show when they first started dropping some of the things that this group, the partisans, had hacked out of the various, state security apparatus in Belarus. And this kind of goes back and looks at that story, has a bunch more details about the kind of the makeup of the group. He said it's something like 15-ish people, a bunch of them that work in the tech industry in Belarus in general, and a few that have some cybersecurity experience, but were kind of learning to hack on the fly, supported by a whole bunch of kind of, expatriate, involuntary expatriate Belarusian police and, other state security people that fled the country after, some of the bad things that went down in the last elections, and then have been providing kind of support and guidance and analytics to help them go through the process of, making the most of the networks that they were gaining access to. And I think, this kind of, we were spitballing at times, like, is this exactly what it sounds like? Is it really, activists and locals?
Well, I think actually when we did initially talk about this, we came down on the side of, well, this actually looks like it might be genuine, yeah, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to see some, kind of stories that back up that gut feel that we had at the time, because we were going on pretty, thin input at that point in the story. But this is just, I was reading this and I'm just struck by, like, this is like really what insider threat looks like. We've seen, so much hay has been made in writing about computer security over the years about the dangers of insiders. This is really the end game of insider, right? When your own national government is using, the people who work the mechanics of your national government's, security apparatus turning against you and then using all those tools against the government. I mean, that's just that's insider threat writ large. And it's really interesting to see.
Yeah. Tom Uren for this week's newsletter is actually writing up a bit of a story about fake hacktivism and real hacktivism, and trying to, you know, how do you actually distinguish between them and whatever. I set up like a signal chat between Tom and Gruck, which was really interesting. I was just a fly on the wall for that. But Gruck's got some really interesting systematic thoughts, or some thoughts on how to systematically kind of determine what's real and what's fake. And, you know, as far as he's concerned, these cyberpartisan, you know, this cyberpartisan crew definitely looks like the real deal. But you contrast that with what we're seeing in Iran with, like, you know, hacktivists taking over the prisons and, like, you know, TV screens at train stations and stuff. And that one just smells like a state-backed op. I mean, the thinking has been Israel, but it could be anyone. I mean, it could be one of the Gulf states or whatever, but it certainly doesn't feel like protesters. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. And I think you're right that this one, you know, Belarus really does feel like a legitimate underground activist sort of thing. And, you know, we've seen so many.
Well, and the fact that there's kind of like now documented links between the Belarus cyber partisans and, you know, other activist groups and whatnot, right? Like, it really feels like when reaching out to other protesters and activists, they're like, oh, yeah, we know these guys, you know? So it certainly does lend credibility to them being the real deal.
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting because we, you know, when you look at the examples of hacktivists that we have to go on, like what are hacktivist groups do? How do they work? How would we tell who are real hacktivists, who are not? And, you know, kind of the examples that we have in the public domain, so many of them are probably, you know, we don't really know, you know, because so much is so opaque around groups like this that, you know, whether or not really is hacktivists, and, you know, or it's state or it's something else with other interests. And that kind of, you know, opacity of motivation, you know, does make it really difficult to tell where we are on the scale of hacktivism being, you know, a legit useful thing that we've seen, you know, wielded effectively, you know, for real change or real purposes, as opposed to kind of, you know, other, you know, states that have other kind of games afoot. So yeah, it's just nice to see one that is gradually getting more documented, that is gradually getting, you know, kind of a depth of evidence and as you said, those relationships with other groups and other people. That's kind of really nice. And I think, you know, I said it last time, you know, when Thomas Ridd writes the next edition of the book about this kind of disinformation stuff, there's going to be a whole big chapter about this, because it's just such an amazing example of what you can do.
And I love it too, because it's about, you know, they're taking on Lukashenko, who's like the undisputed king of dickheads in, you know, like it's really, really hard. Like, it is impossible to side with the Belarusian state against these people, right? Which is what makes it such a fascinating case study as well, is because you can absolutely say that they're on the right side of history doing this stuff. These are crimes that we support.
Yeah, it's nice to have a really clear example like that. There isn't much nuance in that. And that, yeah, that does help, because when you, you know, you see some other regions of the world, you know, where this kind of stuff goes down, and you know, sometimes it's a bit more, you know, convoluted, a bit more involved, whereas this, yeah, really does seem pretty straightforward. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether they succeed. Like, when this is wrapped up, and presumably Lukashenko will be out of power, because that seems like...
Will this have moved the needle?
Yes, exactly, right? Will this really have made an impact or not, right? Is hacktivism really genuinely useful? Because, I mean, intuitively to us, it feels like it really ought to be. Like, having access to, you know, all of the recorded phone calls from the state wiretapping operation seems, and being able to publicize those by taking over the TV station and, you know, broadcasting stuff during the main TV news instead, like, that feels like it ought to be really impactful, but is it?
Did they do that?
Yes.
My God.
I know, right?
That's,
I
mean, awesome. It's amazing. Wicked. That's movies. That is proper movie hacking.
It really is, right? And better quality movie hacking than what the, you know, Israelis are doing in the prisons.
Well, I mean, if it is them, again, but the point is, it's unlikely to be a ragtag bunch of university students
in Tehran. Yes, that does seem
taken on the man, you know, like, just doesn't feel that way. But what surprised me, and this is one thing that we really hope to rectify in the newsletter tomorrow, what surprises me is that, like, none of the stories talking about what's happening here, a lot of this stuff did happen a long time ago. It feels like, for a lot of the people covering this stuff, they weren't around when it happened. But, you know, if you think of, people would have heard us mention the Cutting Sword of Justice a couple of times. Now, of course, this was the group, group that claimed responsibility for a wiper attack against the Saudi Aramco, you know, big Saudi Arabian oil company back, I think, around 2010, 2011. So, you know, a group claimed it. They said they were the Cutting Sword of Justice, and it was Iran. Okay. It was Iran. And this is why we know Iran loves wiper attacks, because they did the Saudi Aramco thing. Right. And then later you had a group claiming the hack against, Sony Pictures was the Guardians of Peace. And that was the North Koreans. Right. So we have established, and then you've got, you know, the Olympic Destroyer stuff going after
Cyber Caliphate and TV5 Mond. I mean,
yep.
So many, yep, right?
The Cyber Caliphate, TV5 Mond, that was Russia. Then you've got the Russian attacks against, you know, the Olympics, and when they were putting like Korean text in it to try to like be like, yes, we're Korean. So there's a long history of like fake hacktivism. And then there's the stuff where we still don't know, which is like Phineas Fisher. Grok had some interesting thoughts on that as well, because he said they were too passionate to be state operators. And I kind of agree with him on that, because when you read their stuff, the reasoning, even if you didn't agree with their conclusions, the way that they would argue about their motivations, the way they would describe their motivations, was too well thought out for it to be some Siginter trying to pretend. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like if you have a committee that's deciding on the manifesto of this, you know, fake hacktivist, then yeah, I think it wouldn't have the clarity. And so anyway, you know, when we read Phineas Fisher's stuff, it did resonate, right? I mean, to those of us that have grown up in the hacker scene, like it did kind of resonate. Like it felt authentic in a way that, yeah, as you say, like the North Koreans pretending to be a hacker didn't really. So
it is exciting to see where it all goes, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And I'm, you know, the rap at the end of whether this actually, as you said, moved the needle, that's going to be really interesting, because, you know, there's been so many of these, like Sony Pictures, what did that do?
I don't think anyone's made a movie ridiculing Kim Jong-un since. So, you know, mission actually, accomplished.
Yeah, maybe that is maybe you're right. By that metric, complete success. Bonuses all round.
Now, look, I want to move on to talk about a piece by Kevin Collier in NBC News. And it sort of trod some ground we've walked before, but I think it is certainly worth revisiting. Basically, he's written a story here that looks at how InfoSec hype on voting machine security kind of fed the people who stormed the Capitol, right? Like this industry, we got to be honest, loves to hype threats.
We do,
right?
We do.
And we've spent so long hyping election and it's not a topic that we really drill into all that much, voting machine security. It's not really a story that I cover that much for this reason, right? Is because, sure, there are attacks that can be carried out against voting machines and we should do more to uplift their security. But at the same time, you can really give a misleading impression by focusing too much on that as a topic. And Kevin's story here really explores how, you know, there's a whole group of people out there who believe that, you know, these elections were stolen by voting machine companies or hackers or whatever, and it's just, you know, it's led us into the hype machine has led us into a pretty bad place.
Yeah, I do agree, and it's interesting to see a story where, you know, because Kevin's gone out and talked to a bunch of the researchers who, you know, run the voting village, you know, voting machine hacking village at DEF CON, and have done a bunch of research and have had their words, you know, used by some of the Trumpers, you know, to kind of justify the election being stolen and how they kind of felt about that. And yeah, you're very right. Like, we do love a good hype. We love a show. I mean, the fact that the main HackerCon's in Vegas, where it's all about, you know, a bit of showmanship, a bit of, you know, pizzazz. And yeah, we are kind of guilty of doing that. And the consequences of that are not always obvious. Sometimes, you know, I guess they are, you know, the voting machines, we kind of knew was going to go like this. Well, maybe not exactly like this, but, you know, it's one of those things where people do love to misconstrue the work. But, you know,
I'm saying is maybe spending 10 years undermining confidence in electronic voting wasn't a great way to go.
Maybe it had a consequence, you know. And, yeah. You know, everyone who worked in that, you know, works in that scene, you know, I'm sure is very sincere in their motivations. But when we do try and explain, you know, the difference between hacking a voting machine and hacking a voting system, you know, a countrywide voting system as a whole thing, that's a nuance that we understand, but is less well communicated when you've got showy hacking demos. I mean, I think of, you know, Barnaby Jack's classic ATM jackpotting attacks on stage. And it's like, there is a big distance from I can make money come out of an ATM to I can compromise an entire banking ecosystem and move money and actually, you know, in the style of the Swift attacks, like that's a systemic attack on the banking as opposed to like, let's just do a flashy jackpot. And if you learned everything about financial system security from ATM hacking, you know, very few banks get hacked through the ATMs. They get hacked through phishing and all the normal sorts of things. And the same is true of election systems. And so you can certainly see why, without that kind of systemic understanding, people would reach the wrong conclusions. But
Well, yeah, and election systems too. I mean, they're audited, right?
Yes,
just
exactly,
as the,
right?
the bank's going to notice that there's cash missing from the ATM, you know, they're going to notice that that vote tallies are looking a bit weird and whatever. And look, as much as we point to the fringe Republicans in the United States who are jumping on board with these loony conspiracy theories, the Democrats can't really escape some blame here either, because they, of course, after the 2016 election, were very careless in their language around hacking and elections and stuff. Oh, you know, the Russians hacked the election was something. They really did conflate the DNC theft with an election hack. And that, again, just made this thing messier than it needed to be. So I think, you know, what's the opposite of a backpat all around?
yeah, exactly. Like a big old kick in the shins to everybody involved.
Yeah, go kick yourself in the shins.
Yeah, exactly.
You all deserve it. But it's nice to see Kevin walk through this. And, you know, I do hope that we can talk about this stuff in a more mature way. But you're right. You look at the showy hacking against an ATM, and it's that same sort of mentality where, okay, in that case, it's kind of harmless, but you take that same mentality into talking about stuff that it turns out is quite important, and, you know, you get all sorts of crazy stuff happening.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the same patterns are evident in, you know, aerospace hacking and satellite hacking, all those kind of, you know, things that make for really great stories, but in no way cover the actual... Like, if you're going to hack satellites, it's way more complicated than actually hacking the, you know, the comms between the radio and the ground station. There's all of the other systems involved. And so, yeah, I think, you know, presenting our findings in context is a thing this industry does struggle with, you know, right from pen testers, bug bounty kids, all the way up through, you know, this kind of stuff.
Another one from Kevin Collier here at NBC. And the T-Mobile CEO has apologized after, you know, 50, 60 million of its records got stolen, which is fair enough. And I think the direct quote is here: the last 2 weeks have been humbling for all of us at T-Mobile. Mm. To say we are disappointed and frustrated that this happened is an understatement. The story also quotes Jackie Singh as saying, well, maybe they should have encrypted social security numbers. Look, I feel like field encryption is a thing that we can do now. So I think that's, while that might have sounded a bit silly a few years ago, I think it's probably baseline these days, isn't it, Adam? Sure.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, there's some places where, I mean, yes, like field level, row level encryption in the database, totally a thing. But quite a lot of these, you know, situations where you lose data are not necessarily stolen directly from the database. Some quite a bit, you know, stolen from APIs, stolen from logs, stolen from, you know, kind of other outputs of the system, which are going through the encryption mechanism. Like, it's, you know, yeah, SQL. If we were just stealing data through SQL injection, then maybe.
Which is, let's be honest, it was T-Mobile is probably how they got it.
Well, I think this was what, like, Telnet on some Unix box.
Oh, that's
on
right,
internet.
Yeah.
So at that point, you probably got all the necessary things to be able to either take data from an API that already decrypts it for you, or steal the key material as well, or access it in some other way. So, you know, there's absolutely cases where it makes sense, and where, you know, if you've got an HSM and you have some, you know, like if you're dealing with card data, then maybe there's enough controls around it. But when it's just general PII that kind of sloshes around the service bus, then, you know, I'm dubious about how useful that, you know, kind of row level crypto really is. Unless you're stealing it off disk or off the database itself.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And it looks like the person who did this, it's an American citizen living in Turkey. I know,
and he just like pops up on social media saying, yeah, that was totally me. Like, what the hell? You have to be really sure about your, you know, extradition status or whatever. Well, it's not really OPSEC when you're putting your name, you know, your full name and giving interviews. So,
yeah.
And like, not even claiming to have done it for some, you know, like, oh, we were trying to alert them about their security, or they didn't pay us a bug bounty. Like,
no, we stole it and we're trying to sell it. Yeah. Who wants to buy it?
I mean, maybe that's good advertising, you know. I don't understand the reasoning.
Might have some consequences there. Bangkok Air has been lock-bitted. They had some data leaked after the countdown expired. They didn't pay and off it went. I think we're going to see more of this, people just not paying. It's funny actually because, God, it went huge on Twitter. We didn't talk about it at the time, but Accenture got... and it was like their cybersecurity division or something got lockbitted But it was such a fizzer, man. Like, we didn't report on it when the counter was running. We didn't report it on report on it afterwards because basically it was like brochures and stuff. Like, it was just so not critical, the info. But yeah, look, Bangkok Air, another one. Again, some fairly boring business documents and a limited set of PII by the looks of things.
Yeah, some reports about passenger data, so passport information, travel information in some sets of cases. But, I mean, that seems, I guess, pretty normal for what you'd expect to come out of an airline.
Do you feel like the tide is turning against the extortion side of it? Because I never really thought that it would become... Because we've seen, like, EA Games didn't pay, Accenture didn't pay, Bangkok Air hasn't paid... Like, you need a bloody good reason to pay someone for data deletion, right? The reason people pay for ransomware, it's not to protect the integrity of their data. It's to get back up and running, right? And without that pressure, I just can't see people from this point on reliably making the decision to pay.
Well, I mean, I guess part of this is, you know, the classic breach notification fatigue thing. Once you've lost your personal data once, the impact of losing it a second time kind of lower. And I do think that, you know, that does factor into some of these conversations. Like, if you're the first person to have a whole bunch of your customer data nicked and leaked, then maybe the pressure is on you to protect it. But when we've seen, you know, breaches in the airline industry, for example, of, you know, a bunch of the big airline, you know, kind of service providers, other airlines, at that point, you know, the average flyer probably has already got half a dozen times their data's been left lying around. So, you know, the value is kind of lower because there's less cost for that. So I think, you know, that maybe does play into, you know, plus, of course, the wider understanding that every time you pay them, you're equipping them to better do this next time. So, you know, I think maybe the tide is turning a little bit, but it is hard to say.
It is. Like, it's a little bit too early to call it a trend, but I just feel like this isn't going to be as big a deal, like, in the public consciousness. This data ransoming stuff is not going to be a big deal. Ransomware, still, yes. But this pay us to delete your files, I just don't see it being a particularly sustainable model. Moving on, we've got a story from the Register here. If you're a criminal in the United Kingdom and you want a gun, we have good news.
So there was a breach of a UK gun dealer called GunTrader. Left their database lying around, got it stolen. It had a whole bunch of details about people accessing GunTrader's systems. Somebody went through and I think geolocated the most recent IPs used to access accounts on GunTrader, and then mapped it out. Built a Google Maps KML file, so that they have a list of all the people who have guns registered, or all the people, the locations of everybody who's used this system, plotted on a map. And of course, you know, there's lots of reasons why that would be useful for, you know, criminals who want to steal guns, you know, get guns they can use in crimes without being attributed to them. We've even seen, you know, some people saying, well, it'll be used by anti-fox hunting activists to go and, you know,
that's a hell of an angle.
Stop toffs from hunting foxes.
Congratulations to anyone where that was their first angle. But this, you know, this data set does include home addresses as well, right? So it is a problem. And I think it's interesting because the story does say that gun theft from private residences in the United Kingdom is actually kind of rare, but, you know, maybe that's because this data set wasn't out there.
Yeah, I did see on Twitter somewhere at least one, you know, not sure of correlation or causation, someone who had their house robbed and their gun safe broken into in the UK, you know, like yesterday sort of thing. Who knows? But, yeah.
Yeah, that's a stretch. That's why I didn't mention that. I saw that tweet as well. But it's just, yeah, I mean, come on. Could be a coincidence.
Yes, absolutely could be.
But, you know, this is the thing in countries where there are strict controls on guns, where you can't just walk to your local Kmart or whatever and walk out with an AR-15, this sort of data is of value to criminal organizations. So hopefully this isn't going to be a thing, you know. And you know, we've seen some discourse on Twitter, people saying, well, you know, aren't guns required to be kept in safes? And it's like, yeah, which is why they'll knock on your door and beat you over the head with a rubber hose until you give them a gun.
Exactly, yes. There's if you're willing to break the law, then you have a whole bunch of other options available to you.
Another one of these. Why do I laugh when I talk about these? I shouldn't laugh. Another one of these decentralized finance platforms got, you know, wrote an application badly, and someone used a bug in this blockchain app to basically loop through some procedure which is normally used to do loans, like flash loans or whatever, and managed to steal $29 million in crypto assets. So, you know, nice payday for them.
Certainly, you know, we've had a couple of gigs at work where we've reviewed this kind of, you know, Ethereum, you know, smart contract blockchain sort of apps. And, you know, everyone who writes code makes mistakes. That's normal. The fact that you then hook that up to an automated system that gives other people your money and then act surprised when the money goes missing, I mean, it's just, I don't know what they expected with this whole Ethereum smart blockchain, smart contract blockchain idea. But yeah, I mean, $20 million for just repeatedly calling the please loan me some Ether API, smooth. You know, if I was a punk kid criminal and I wanted to go, like, this just seems like such a great way to turn technical skills into money without the inconvenience of dealing with bug bounty programs. So yeah, I mean,
Trail of Bits did a lot of work on this Ethereum, you know, on these Ethereum smart contract things. And they're like, you know, there are so many rookie mistakes people are making. But the thing is, you can get great auditors to come in, people who really understand the security of these things. And if you miss one thing, this is the impact, right? Yes. And that's probably why I laugh, because that the impact can be so huge is probably why I think, just as a concept, it's problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it is, right? And you can do it so quickly, right? It's one thing to make a mistake in a banking app, which then, you know, everything's very slow process. With this, it's just kind of instantaneous. And I mean, I just look at that kind of, you know, that kind of money, and I think, you know, what's the total value of all the pen tests that, you know, we've sold in the last 15 years? And how does that compare to finding one bug and one piece of blockchain code and then cashing out? It's like, that's a good business case angle right there. I'm down.
Yeah, so Insomnia could have gone rogue instead.
We should have pivoted to crime. That would have been a much smarter
pivoting
idea.
To crime instead of being acquired by cybersecurity. whose comms people are probably listening to this and having a stroke. Oh, so no. Hello to you if you're listening.
No, forgive me, Mel.
What do we got here? We got a report from the Washington Post some weeks ago. We reported about how you know, all of that genetic data from Wuhan somehow wound up in the possession of the United States intelligence community. And no surprises here, but the US intelligence community has not really been able to figure out the true origin of the, you know, COVID-19. It says that the consensus seems to be that it could have come from an animal or it could have come from a lab leak in Wuhan, China. So it looks like we're right back where we started with all of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's pretty much no solid or, you know, kind of concrete conclusions from this. There's some, like, low confidence, maybe it came from the lab. There did seem to be some general consensus that it's probably not a bioweapon, so that's nice. You know?
That's nice, yeah. That just turned the dial on World War III down just a tiny bit. So,
but yeah, we don't really know, and they've said that, you know, without cooperation from the Chinese government, then probably it's not going to go much further. Biden seems pretty keen to make it go further, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, this was always going to be a hard ask, you know, kind of doing this kind of investigation without the support of the local government. You know, you'd have to have pretty good access, and I guess they did have good access, but as we, you know, we joked last time, there's so many people up in the Wuhan virology lab that, you know, who even knows? I'm sure they moved that stuff offline into their cold wallet now so they don't get it, you know, their virus is nicked. But yeah, so we don't know, and maybe it's better that way.
Yes, maybe it is. But I mean, it just goes to show that SIGINT and then subsequent analysis can't answer every question, because it's not magic. So that's worth keeping in mind. I do just want to mention something quickly that's not InfoSec related, but it's just something that I found very, very interesting. And I think maybe some other listeners will too. There was a pandemic in the late 19th century. Some people referred to it as the Russian flu pandemic. But there's a growing body of evidence to suggest that it was actually a coronavirus pandemic. It looks like it jumped to humans, ripped around the world in successive waves that reduced in amplitude, mostly affected the elderly. The symptoms seem exactly like COVID-19, so a little bit different to influenza, really. And there's some genetic evidence to suggest that it was a coronavirus. But I just found that very, very interesting. And there's some good stuff to read there if you're interested in reading about what was possibly the last global coronavirus pandemic. Oh, we've got another announcement, Adam, from the White House about pipeline security. I feel like this could be the same one. They're just saying it again, or it could be like the sixth announcement of pipeline security measures. They really love their pipelines in America.
sure do.
But this comes after there was that cyber summit in Washington where they got like Microsoft and IBM and a few others together to have a powwow and say, yeah, you know, security's good. We're going to commit. And I love Microsoft's announcement, which is they're going to spend $20 billion over 5 years on their security products, all right? Although now they're saying, oh, it's cybersecurity by design. So I think it's kind of weird when you go to a summit and then you say, yes, as a result of this summit, we are going to spend money on R&D on our own products, which is something that we were
going to
obviously
do anyway.
Already doing and going to continue to do. Yay us. And was it Amazon turned up and promised to give away security keys, like I'm presuming U2F keys to all of its users.
Like, which is funny because, you know, like Microsoft's saying we're going to spend $20 billion and Google's like we're going to spend $10 billion and Amazon says we're going to give everybody a $20 U2F token. So,
I mean, which is going to be more effective?
Well,
though,
that's
right?
The funny like, that's thing, right? One of these is tangible.
Speaking of which, actually, Caesar has actually issued, you know, we get all these best practices lists out of government departments and it's like, yeah, you should do this, you should do that. Caesar actually has a bad practices list. And number three on that list is now single factor auth.
Which I think is really good. You know, we've seen, you know, the uptake of multi-factor auth be pretty important in making a bunch of the common avenues of attack go away or at least get reduced. And yeah, having this, you know, especially in a, you know, Caesar list is just really helpful because, I mean, you know, almost every report we ship still has the you have single factor auth, have you considered multi-factor auth, it's best practice. It's nice to have something else to point to as well. The interesting thing, Caesar also has a list of other things that they are considering putting on their list of bad practices, and all of them are things that ought to be on the bad practices list, you know, like sticking your IT network and your OT network together or giving everybody admin. So hopefully all these things end up on their list of bad ideas, because the fact that, you know, don't use unsupported software and don't use, you know, password one or admin default creds, Cisco, the fact that that's on the list, I feel like all of these other things ought to be on the list as well.
Don't shoot self in face. Controversial. Don't shoot self in face. Oh, now look, walk us through this Azure Cosmos database thing, because I got to be honest, I don't quite get what's going on here despite the headlines it's generated. There was someone found some issue involving an Azure service called Cosmos DB and they patched it, but now people need to remediate it because there might be key exposure. But like, walk us through this because I don't get it.
So Cosmos DB is an Azure kind of cloud database service which, you know, has been around for a couple of years now, a few years now. The researchers in question found a mechanism where you could get authentication tokens for other people's Cosmos databases through they had some integration with the Jupyter Notebook, which is a piece of software that people use for kind of rapidly building applications and data query systems, I guess. So it's kind of like an IDE, but for building, you know, kind of data queries and machine learning and those kinds of things. And it's kind of tightly integrated to a build and execution environment to make it smooth to use repeatedly. And so there was a mechanism where you could kind of stand up a Jupyter Notebook that used your Cosmos DB and then pull in data from somebody else's Cosmos DB. And through some mechanism that I don't think we've seen the specifics released yet, you could cause auth tokens for somebody else's database to just be given to you. And then at that point, you had access to their data, and that's clearly bad in a multi-tenanted cloud environment. They told the researchers, Wiz, told Microsoft about this, and they got it patched in a couple of days. But the concern is that it's been like this probably forever. And if you had got the key material out in the past, you can probably still use that long-term key material to maintain access to those databases. And so even if the bug itself is fixed...
Now, I mean, you've just explained it, right? Because... Yeah. Because what they were saying, right, like the reason I got confused is they're like, oh, you know, you can access data in somebody else's database, right? I didn't realize it was auth tokens, and that makes a whole bunch more sense now.
Yes. Yeah. I think effectively you got an auth token to use the cloud APIs to call into their databases, which clearly bad and honestly is the sort of thing that is pretty, I mean, why the headlines have been, you know, saying this is worst case, like this really is for a cloud service, the opposite of what you want, right? I mean, it's just, you know, cross-tenant access, cross-user access is
it's
really
sort of the
bad.
Equivalent of a hypervisor bypass in like AWS or something on EC2. It's bad, right?
Yeah, it's bad, right? I mean, if you could just kind of get keys to use somebody else's EC2 boxes, that would be catastrophic. Same with S3. Like if you could just read other people's S3 bucket contents, that would be, you know, catastrophic for most people that use those for handling corporate data. So it is bad. I mean, it's kind of somewhat helped by all of the cloud things having dumb names so that no one really knows what you're talking about. I mean, if you try and talk about any new Amazon AWS service, they've all got some stupid name that has no idea what it is. And like, what's a Cosmos DB? Like if this was MySQL in the cloud, people would understand, I think, better what they were talking about. So, you know, cloud stuff's just really difficult. And of course, the lack of visibility into how long or how much. Microsoft says there's no evidence that this had been used in the past, but I mean
I'm sure they've been over the logs for every customer for the last 2 years to make that determination.
All of the customers that were E5 and paid for logs, maybe. but yeah, exactly. We have to take their word for that investigation. And obviously the incentives for cloud providers are very, very strongly in favor of you know, not lowering trust in their systems. So
yeah, they're not going to force force a key or token rotation. Like, forget it. That's not happening, right? Which I guess is why the Department of Homeland Security in the United States is urging Microsoft customers to do that rotation. But it is a tricky one, right? Because rotating those access keys is going to be a pain in the ass, right?
And who even knows how they work or how you do it or where they are? Or, I mean, you know, because all of this cloud stuff is very new and we don't see the inner workings of it, you know, in the old, like right now, if you had to go roll your Kerberos ticket grinding ticket key, at least we understand how that works and we understand the consequences of doing that and we have some idea of how to do it because we can see the insides and we've got some experience. This cloud stuff is all so new and everyone has so little idea of how it actually works that, you know, the fact that there is a key at all, most people probably don't. What's the service? Most people don't know. Is there a key? Who knows? Where is it used? How do we rotate? Answering all of those questions is probably a week or two of research, you know, which is just
well, exactly, because you're going to, yeah, if you rotate the keys and you know the primary application uses these keys, right, that's great. But you know you're going to break something somewhere else that you forgot about or you don't know
exactly
about.
Who knows how – I mean, even just drawing a diagram of how all of your cloud services interact and how each one of them auths to each other component and what the lifetimes of those auths are. Where they're, like, we've done this exercise for some customers, and it's just – it's intractable, you know, just building that diagram of how your system actually practically works is almost intractable, even for experts.
Now, this next story from Portswigger, from the Daily Swig, I found really interesting because I just had the Trailer Bits guys on the show talking about their research into, you know, unsafe serialization in machine learning models. And particularly they were talking about how most of them are shared via Python pickle files and that's bad. And, you know, they built tools to mess with Python pickle files and to analyze them and whatnot. But one thing that came up in the interview, and I'm not sure I may have even cut this, is I said at one point, like, I'm pretty sure it stayed in actually, but I said at one point, like, you know, this whole discipline is sort of coalescing around some open source software and the track record isn't necessarily there yet. And it hasn't really been looked at. And then bang, here we got a story about bugs in TensorFlow.
Yeah, this was this is actually an interesting one. It's code exec through YAML deserialization when you're passing around data, you know, for people to use with the TensorFlow machine learning package. And it's interesting because the machine learning world is like there's such a commingling of kind of logic and data. Like, I mean, they're passing around what is functionally executable code. It's not necessarily executed on the bare machine, but like executed in ML runtimes or the output of learning. And that kind of commingling of data and instruction is interesting architecturally. And then, of course, to then see an example of, you know, actually just straight up deserialization in the sorts of things people are passing around. I guess what I mean is people are less, like, if you are passing around binaries, to like executable files, people might be a bit more thoughtful about the supply chain. But the fact that you're passing around what are essentially kind of opaque blobs of training material or whatever else, there's a lot less thought given to the risks of that. And this is a great example of, you know, how you'd be able to own a bunch of people who are, you know, using pre-trained models and that kind of thing through, you know, YAML serialized files, which is probably, I imagine, one of the most prevalent formats that are used. And Google's actually, the Google team that's behind the open source project, have actually pulled support for YAML out of TensorFlow for a while, whilst they figure out, you know, ways to patch this. So yeah, pretty reasonable impact for, you know, a small but quite important bit of the ecosystem.
Yeah, well, congratulations to Arjun Shibu, who found that. That's, you know, that's interesting stuff. And I suspect we'll be seeing more of that sort of thing. Next story, not strictly InfoSec, but we had to include it because it's kind of funny. It's a Tom Brewster story from Forbes. Looks at one of those hitman for hire scammers who just trawls the dark web saying, yeah, I'm gonna kill people for money. Send me your bitcoins. They take the bitcoins and then obviously they don't kill the people. But what's really interesting is it's a story about how one of these people became an informant for the FBI because they were like, yeah, I took money. This person paid $5,000 for me to kill someone. So that person's probably in danger. You want to go protect them. It's just really funny, which is just obviously, yeah, there are people out there who are, well, I'm a scammer, but I want to give someone a heads up when someone's gunning for them. Jeez.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, it's kind of a heartwarming tale in a way, you know, the the murder for hire scammer turned gold, you know. But no, I mean, exactly, right? If you're taking money for people to kill them, then, yeah, I guess go telling the FBI does seem like the responsible thing to do. I'm sure they also pay their taxes on the money that they're scamming scamming people out of for you know, hitman services. But yeah, I mean, this was some like some guy's mistress that was trying to get the wife whacked, or yeah, I mean,
yeah, unfortunately, yeah. No, there's a case study in there that just is wild reading. But it's funny because we used to say that, like, you know, chances are when you're commissioning a murder over the dark web, you're speaking to an FBI agent. But it turns out even if you're not speaking to an FBI agent, it's probably going to wind up with the FBI
exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. So everyone who wants to procure murder for hire, maybe, you know, rethink your life choices.
Isn't that nice, though, that, you know, this is something that we used to worry about some years ago. We worried about this burgeoning murder-for-hire market on the dark web, and it turns out it's just a great way for catching people who want to murder.
Yeah, but that seems like a good outcome.
Yeah, glass half full, man. Yeah, let's exactly. Go. Now, Sean Lingus, too, first of all, congratulations to him, because it looks like he's off to a new job at CNN. So congratulations, Sean. We will miss your work at cyberscoop.com. But he's published an absolute cracker here. It looks like this is based on reports that he pulled together in Vegas, but it's about a gentleman named Mohammed Al-Dub from Kuwait, who had a very bad time for tweeting about an interesting find on VirusTotal. This is just hell. This is like what he went through, this poor guy.
And who hasn't done that, right? Who hasn't found something juicy in VT and you know, had a rummage? But no, this was so a bank in Kuwait had been having some issues. They had said, you know, we're having some, you know, computer issues or availability issues or something. And you know, that's usually code for we're being hacked. And this guy found on VT some malware that had been submitted that had a username that was like GBK admin. The bank was Gulf Bank, I guess. So, you know, plausibly could be the username. Tweeted about it saying, hey, here's potential IOC for maybe what's going down, the incident they're having at the bank. Bank did not like this and went and eventually caused the Kuwaiti authorities to like file charges for kind of saying bad things about them on the internet. And this took, you know, some years to then grind through.
It took like a year and a half to resolve.
Yeah. Which, that's a rough day. And of course, this guy, you know, he deleted the tweets and stuff. But I mean, yeah, kind of ruined his life for a couple of years on the back of, you know, just some public information and, you know, a few reasonable guesses that I imagine were a little too on the nose, like a little too correct.
Now, look, we got a write-up here from Joe Cox at Vice Motherboard, and essentially what this write-up is explaining the fact that Team Kumari have access to a whole bunch of NetFlow, right? And this is, look, I think this story is right in that that's kind of been a bit of a dirty secret of the security discipline for quite a while, which is that NetFlow data on like regular people is in these data sets, and that could constitute a privacy risk. Now, I'm personally not too concerned about that because NetFlow doesn't really tell us as much about a person as it used to. And it's also like a fairly useless data set unless you can correlate it with things like subscriber records, et cetera, right? So what NetFlow is most useful for is like, say in the case of the Colonial Pipeline hack, the reason people had such a good idea of what had happened there so quickly is largely because of this NetFlow stuff, right? Because you can just pull it up and it's like this passive global capability that is accessible to incident responders and stuff through to Team Kumari. But look, Joe's done a write-up here sort of saying, well, you know, there's some privacy risks here and is this a good thing, etc. I think it's a conversation that's worth having, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. And you can, I mean, looking at the trajectory of Joe's previous work on, you know, kind of data being collected and then sold, you know, by mobile operators or telcos or whatever else. Like, I can totally see why this has ended up on his radar, but it is quite different than, you know, some of those commercial, you know, marketing, kind of marketing-centric deals where telcos would sell access to, you know, data brokers or whatever else. But I mean, there's always been this sort of underground, you know, bunch of security people and network operators that at an engineering level have been sharing this kind of data, sharing this kind of access, you know, and the Team Kumari people, you know, along with a few other groups of kind of similar nature, you know, they've been around for a long time sharing data that, you know, if the execs at the top of the companies understood what it was, might be a bit squeamish about it. But that's kind of, you know, this has been a very much a grassroots, you know, kind of engineering data sharing underground for a long time amongst incident responders and security people and whoever else. And it is by and large used for good, you know, and same with like passive DNS, for example. I mean, there's a bunch of other kind of, you know, similar sets of data that people have access to. I mean, even VirusTotal back in the old days when it was pretty new, you know, was kind of in the same sort of pattern. And we've seen these data sets become more commercialized because they are so useful for so many things. And as you say, you have to be able to correlate it with other stuff. And it's kind of different than when it's being explicitly sold to target end consumers, as opposed to this kind of security investigation and other things that we use, you know, these underground sources, you know, good underground sources for. But yeah, the times have changed, right? It isn't the world that it was in the early 2000s when, you know, a bunch of network engineers could just do this stuff without anyone really minding or caring or understanding why it was important. So yeah, maybe it's time for, you know, another conversation about some of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think in its current use, right, like I don't see much of a privacy risk. But if Team Comrie, come on, man, I got the pronunciation wrong last time. What is it?
I said Team Comrie, but...
I think it's Team Comrie. Yeah, but anyway, Welsh, what are you going to do, exactly, right? But I think I think really in this case, like the way it's being used now is actually kind of okay. Like I can't see them on selling this data to data brokers who use it for commercial purposes, right? But should we have more formal safeguards around it? I don't know. I just think this will limp along for a while until we can show some harms, you know, which in the case of mobile app data, we can show those harms. In the case of NetFlow being used by incident responders and like threat hunters and whatnot, it's kind of hard to make the same case, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, this is largely data collected by good people for good purposes, right? And that's...
Who are not doing anything, taking subsequent steps or correlating it against other data sets to try to de-anonymize people. That's not really what this stuff is used for.
No, certainly. I mean, you certainly could, and I'm sure like any big data set, there's going to be some people who use it for the wrong purposes. But, you know, by and large, this, you know, this particular kind of underground scene of data sharing for technical security purposes is really net good.
Well, it's not really underground anymore, well, which I think is kind of the point of the story, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yes.
Anyway, link to that story is in the show notes. And we're going to end with our skateboarding dog, Adam, courtesy of Brian Krebs at KrebsOnSecurity.com.
So in 2018, this guy called Andrew Schober downloaded an Ethereum wallet from like Reddit because that's a sensible place to start your financial
sort of
planning.
Ties back to our conversation about DeFi earlier, but yeah.
And then he, so he got a Trojan Ethereum wallet, which would like switch out the destination address to transfers. And then he sent somebody like 16 Bitcoins. So like $1 million worth of Bitcoin. I don't know what he's doing with $1 million worth of Bitcoin in a wallet he downloaded from Reddit, but you know, who am I to judge? Anyway, so he lost a bunch of money. And then he actually went through the steps of, you know, getting people who understood blockchain forensics and getting some private investigators and pulled the thread and eventually identified that his money had been stolen by like two British school children. So then he writes a letter to the parents of these kids saying, hey, your son Oliver nicked, you know, $1 million from me. Well, $100,000.
Well, it's $1 million now, yes, but at the time it was about 145,000 quid.
Yes. So, but it was still, you know, reasonable money and certainly a lot for a school kid to have nicked. He sent the parents a letter saying, hey, here is all the evidence that your kids stole my money. If you just want to give it back or just leave it there, that'll be fine. Otherwise, I'm going to go and, you know, pursue a case against you. And the parents just like didn't answer. So I think eventually now there was a lawsuit and the parents are arguing that it's past the statute of limitations because it was, you know, took him 2 years to track down, two or three years, whatever it was, to track down the kids who'd done it. And it's not giving the money back. Like, what sort of example are you setting for your children there, parents? And of course, the funny thing is the kid had their like Trojan wallet software on their GitHub. And then like the day after they stole the Bitcoin, they were like posting asking about how to move it around or something on the GitHub just. So, you know, clearly not hardened criminals here.
It's a crazy old world. Hey, and before we go, I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, I've linked through in the show notes to that paper that we mentioned last week. Where we talked about the American Academy of Sciences work on evaluating the suitability of probabilistic risk assessment methods in securing nuclear weapons, right? And spoke about their conclusions and whatnot last week. A bunch of people have asked me for a link to that. So I have pasted that into this week's show notes, so you can go grab it there. And just one last thing before we go. Last week, you remember I repeated a very bad joke because a listener had promised to give $50 to a charity of our choice. In the end, I chose an Australian food bank charity. In reply to me tweeting about that, Rowdy, aka The Cyber, on Twitter said, "Hey, next week, say that pee is stored in the balls." And I said that it cost him $500 to the food bank. And he actually agreed to that. So to everyone who needs to understand that the undisputed scientific fact is that pee is indeed stored in the balls. And that will result in a $500 donation to Food Bank Australia. Thank you very much for that, Rowdy.
How did we end up like this?
Hey, I'll only demean myself like this if it's for a good cause, okay? And I'm going to match that donation too. So that's $1,000 raised for Food Bank. People doing a tough here, can't work, lockdown. It's for a good cause. So sorry if we've offended anyone with our potty talk.
Or the biologists.
But it is about getting... it is about getting food into people's stomachs. So let's just think of it that way. But Adam, that is it for this week's news. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news headlines. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Daniel Schell and Dave Cottingham of Airlock Digital. Airlock makes an allow listing product that is actually usable. And I'm doing some work with Airlock outside of the Risky Biz stuff. And I am absolutely mainlining the Kool-Aid on this one at this point, because like I said at the top of the show, I think it is kind of nuts that we allow users in enterprise environments to just execute whatever code they want. And, you know, we rely on system permissions and security software to mitigate the risks inherent in that. Now, of course, there are reasons that's how things are done. There is a reason we are where we are, of course. But I don't think people realize quite how well some of this, like, kill me, but next generation allow listing stuff works. You know, things don't have to be this way. So with Airlock, you can install it and run a baseline for a couple of weeks. You block the lol bins you don't need because it has a block listing feature as well. And you allow software from the more trustworthy publishers that are present in your environment. And bang, you know, the effort required to maintain that is very, very small. And your baseline level of security on your desktops is so much higher than it was before you did that. And it's relatively cheap considering the value that it delivers. I think their pricing is in the order of about $5 per user per month. Anyway, a quick bit of history before we get going. You know, EDR, Endpoint Detection and Response, is all the rage these days, and for good reason. Before EDR was a thing, we didn't really have a great host-based logging and response tool, you know, instrumentation tool. So EDR was born from the enterprise need to detect incidents and then to remediate them without it turning into a level 5 cluster f- every single time. But gradually, EDR evolved to play more of a preventative role, and it does it actually, you know, pretty well. It's an improvement over the traditional AV and endpoint security packages it displaced. But the thing is, it's not perfect. And, you know, if you ask any red teamer, they'll say the same thing. Yes, EDR causes them some grief, but it doesn't work quite as well as a preventative control as people think it does. There are established bypass techniques that are, these days, pretty reliable. Now, this isn't to say that EDR is bad or useless or you shouldn't use it, but what I am trying to say is there's only so far you can go with endpoint security when there's very little execution control on that host. And that's where Airlock Digital comes in. They make an allow listing package that is easy to manage, but also has a block listing component. Not for malware, like that's not their block list. They block list stuff like lol bins. So most of the bypasses and endpoint security tools are only possible thanks to there being no restrictions on things like lol bins. With Airlock, though, you can do stuff like only allow trusted software to load PowerShell, to invoke PowerShell, or only allow this user group to use that other thing. It's an absolutely fantastic preventative control, and the effort you need to put into setting it up and running it is more than offset by the effort you save on the detection and remediation side. Like the number of events you're responding to really does reduce. So in other words, if you run Airlock with your CrowdStrike, and they have a lot of customers who use both, your EDR goes back to being a tool that does what it's best at, which is detection and response. Now, of course, nothing is impossible to bypass. That's not what I'm saying. AirLock is not magic. But I am saying it's a lot harder to get around it if you've configured it right than it is to get around EDR. Anyway, this intro is getting kind of long. But as I say, I am drinking the Kool-Aid, so that's why. So two of the AirLock Digital founders are joining me now to talk about a paper from the University of Piraeus in Greece. It is called An Empirical Assessment of Endpoint Detection and Response Systems Against Advanced Persistent Threat Attack Vectors, and it basically walks through a bunch of EDR bypass techniques. It's been doing the rounds for the last little while on InfoSec Twitter, and yeah, it is a good read. Dave Cottingham and Daniel Schell join me to talk about the paper and the topic of EDR bypasses, and the first voice you'll hear here is Daniel Schell talking about how EDR bypass has really just become the same old arms race whack-a-mole as we were in before.
Yeah, well, yeah, people will assume EDR in lots of cases, or they'll know that the target runs EDR, right? And which brand, right? Look on LinkedIn, they're skilled in this platform, right? So yeah, it's really uplifted the game. So people aren't just trying like the single executable, you know, they're making these complex attack chains to try to get around it. So they'll be like, okay, well, I'm going to have this HTA file or this, you know, control panel applet, which links into this other thing, which will try to run some JavaScript into a .NET assembly. And now we'll create a thread, right? And they're just trying to dodge it because they know if they do it this way, then there's a detection. They know if they do it this way, there's a detection. So, you know, pen testers and attackers are trying to find the ways where, oh, they don't have a rule for this, or they don't have a detection. And we're back to like standard rules, rule sets, block lists, and it's just not a, you know, proactive way of doing things. And for us, it's actually great because, you know, they have to code execute so many times across the kill chain because they have to launch the HTA, they have to inject this DLL. Like all these things for us are places where we're looking and saying, hey, well, you know, that's not trusted, don't run it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? Is like, as much as EDR is the new and shiny thing, it is pretty much just AV again.
Well, it's sort of turning that way. You know, of course, there's the, you know, machine learning and the other bits they've added along the way. I think it's also a little bit, there's that gap, right? Like, where's the detection actually happening? Is it on the endpoint itself? Or does the endpoint just send the data and then the cloud, when it receives it, it goes, oh, there's a detection. But you've already bolted, but it's already happened, right? And now you're in the response cleanup cycle, right? Rather than it didn't run.
I mean, for me, the thing is like that I've always said about EDR is that it came along as a sort of endpoint logging collection agent, which was very useful and something that we should have had a long time before that. And then the EDR companies realized, hey, if we bolt AV onto this thing, we can displace the AV companies. And, you know, that's why we are where we are now. It was sort of never supposed to be some sort of brilliant thing that stopped badness from happening on the devices in the first place. But that seems to be why people are buying it.
Yeah, I feel like EDR was originally an incident response tool, like forensics sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and then people went, oh, the incident would be over and, you know, Mandiant's tools would still be there. And the customer would be like, can I keep this? Your great visibility. And then it turns into, oh, well, but there's a product here, right?
Yeah, I think there is a bit of that. So look, you know, the thing that we want to talk about today is, of course, this paper that came out of a Greek university. It's written by George Karantzas and Konstantinos Paksikas. They've written a paper doing the rounds. It's been published in the Journal of Cybersecurity and Privacy. And it really is just looking at EDR bypasses. I'm actually, look, and no, none of these academic papers are perfect, but I'm actually quite happy that this one is out there because it just shows how effective bypass techniques are against EDR these days. I mean, was that your reading of it as well?
It's a great paper, right? Because it's not just full technical, like, you know, it's got nice screenshots and it's easy to read. It's not like your traditional academic thing. And what I've already found, yeah, you know, they're just saying, hey, you know, you're relying on everyone to say they're great at security, so let's do some testing. And they have. And they've used pretty modern tradecraft in this paper. And it's been really enlightening. And it's sort of like, it's really interesting because they have access to a lot of those tools, right? They've obviously got themselves a copy of all the major EDR vendors and AV vendors. So when you're looking at the results here, you can sort of see, you know, for us, it's great. We get a bit of a look on like the options and configurability and the findings that they're finding. And, you know, definitely they're just using sort of pretty commodity, like if you're on the Twitter space, they're using those sort of techniques. Right.
Yeah. So standard lolbin stuff. Well, David Cottingham is with us as well. I mean, that again kind of underscores why I wanted to talk about this, where we're saying, oh yeah, they're just using the standard bypass techniques. Whereas I think a lot of CISOs even don't quite realize that there is a whole bag of standard bypass techniques for EDR.
Yeah, exactly. And I think throughout the paper, they're going to all the different GitHubs that seem to be popping up every single week at the moment, where you can copy a binary and, you know, try and change its signature or change characteristics about X to bypass Y. And this stuff is just, you know, out there for research purposes, but it's just being picked up by the attackers to be used every day. And, you know, a lot of the companies are just seeing these type of tools and writing reactive detections to these type of things in order to be able to prevent attacks. One of the call-outs in the paper actually that I found really interesting was about McAfee in particular, where the authors basically said that one of the attack methods, which was dropping an HTA file, didn't work because there was a configurable option in McAfee that said, don't allow HTA to execute, right? And they said, you know, unfortunately, we couldn't execute that file. But isn't that, I guess, a fantastic mitigation by just blocking it? And it blocks the entire class of attack rather than trying to look at maybe the malicious bits of those HTAs. There was also another configuration option in Sophos, which is prevent DLLs loading from untrusted folders. That was an on-off toggle. Now, there's a lot of questions about what an untrusted folder is, but, you know, it's sort of trying to go towards that proactive security. Let's just cut off avenues of attack completely from the attacker. And that was what I found really interesting out of this paper, which is talking about EDR, which is
they're kind of validating your approach, right?
There's just really simplistic things that are just working, right? So yeah.
Well, I think we should explain too, right? Like, so a lot of the problem with previous allow listing solutions is they were just that. They were allow listing solutions, but yours is more of a hybrid allow and block list solution where you can do things like restrict the availability of living off the land binaries or LOL bins, as they're known, right? So a lot of the bypass techniques that will work against something like Microsoft's App Locker, they just won't work against AirLock.
Yeah, we take, I guess, the approach that complexity is the enemy and try and prevent these things at the lowest ground level. And yes, we do need to think about things like LOLBAS or LOL bins on the endpoint as well, because it's not just about that proactive code execution. So, you know, I think the gap that we really need to bridge, and, you know, this goes, I guess, for the whole industry, is you mentioned before that a lot of CISOs aren't aware of things like LOL bins and things like that. How do we create tooling that allows those, you know, those endpoint teams to be able to lock down those type of that type of functionality on the endpoint that is allowing those type of attacks to occur in a really simple way? You know, on-off toggles are great. Maybe something a little bit more comprehensive than that. You know, but I think we just need to make that type of tooling to these sort of more, I guess, advanced techniques. And I am doing air quotes, but you know, just because.
Well, they're not advanced anymore. Using a LOL bin to, you know, spin up some execution of something that you want to execute, you know, that's just standard behavior now. And it is kind of nuts that there aren't too many companies out there that are offering tools like yours that are just designed to actually secure Windows machines and Windows environments by blocking off those attacker paths. And that doesn't affect system functionality. It doesn't affect the use of the system. I mean, there are edge cases, of course, right? You're always going to have a customer that needs to leave something dumb turned on. But in the in the bulk of case studies that I've walked through with you, like, it's just not an issue.
Yeah, and it's about how you handle those edge cases in a graceful way that people understand what they're doing. One thing that was mentioned in this EDR paper was that the overall security of a lot of the tooling is highly depends on the human factor. You know, the ability to get an alert, to be able to understand it, to be able to react to it, you need a good team. And it's about, yeah, just same thing with the LOL bins. It's about trying to make people aware of what they are, how it impacts them, how to lock it off, but also understand those use cases where they may need them and to be able to, you know, process that in a graceful way.
Yeah. Daniel, like, I can tell he's jumping. He's itching to jump in here.
I'll say, because like, there's things like the Microsoft recommended block rules, right? Which is just a big collection of big XML they provide for WDAC, which we consume that as well. And the Australian standards for allow listing say, hey, you need to implement this, right? And if you just plug that into any organization, it's going to like destroy the network, right? No PowerShell, no WMIC, there's a lot of things that all your developers will not compile code ever again, right? No MS build. So, you know, what we do generally is that, you know, our approach there is we'll go, okay, well, let's run that in an auto mode. We'll do some learning. And what people will find is they'll go, oh, WMIC is getting called all the time. Every time someone makes a Palo VPN connection, you know, as part of its network health check, it's going to run WMIC, right? So our customers go, okay, great. Well, rather than just delete the WMIC or have the toggle of block Microsoft recommended block list rules, they'll go, we'll allow it to run when Paolo is calling it. Cool.
Yeah.
Nice, done. And you tune it up. And you know, that way you've still got the intent of the control and you're not just butchering the rule set or deleting entire classes of things for its purpose. And it gives you that middle ground where it's sort of tied to your environment. And if down the track you see WMIC called by something else in the environment that's never been called before, again, well, let's look into that.
And here's my position. You tell me if you agree with me. I'm sure you do, right? This isn't to say that EDR isn't something you should run, right? But in my view, EDR is something that you want to run for that logging use case and for that threat hunt use case and for that response use case. But in terms of like preventing badness from actually happening on the endpoints, you know, a hybrid allow and block list product is going to work better.
That's exactly what we're about at the end of the day. And like, you know, there's definitely value, like you're saying, in that visibility, right? So an example is, of course, you know, at the end of the day, if Airlock says, hey, Word tried to run this PowerShell file and we blocked that, right? So we go, okay, well, we blocked that and we'll say, well, Word blocked it. But, you know, if you want to know how it got into Word, it came from Outlook as an phishing attachment, well, EDR talk completes that picture, right? You know, we're trying to make our product sort of as simple as possible to manage and operate, which is one of the traditional sort of challenges in allow listing. So we keep things as simple as possible. But if you want that advanced call tree type stuff, then, you know, EDR is great, a great complement to that. And, you know, we have an integration with, like, for example, CrowdStrike, where you click a little, the little falcon and it takes you directly to that matching event in their platform. So then you can go, okay, cool, I can trace it back from there, how it got to the point that thing was blocked.
All right. Well, Dave Cottingham, Daniel Schell, thank you so much for joining me on the show to, you know, have a little bit of a talk really about EDR bypasses and why maybe people should consider some sort of execution control platform like Airlock Digital. It's very good. It was a very good chat. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks.
That was Daniel Schell and David Cottingham from Airlock Digital there with a chat about EDR bypasses and the role of allow listing in the whole show that is InfoSec in 2021. You can find them at airlockdigital.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.